Okay, good evening and welcome to tonight's Monroe City Council meeting. This is the study session for Tuesday, February 27th, 2018. The time right now is 7:01 PM. Ms. Hassler, will you please call the roll?
Council members present from establishing the quorum are Scarborough, Camp, Cuddeback, Gamble, Rasmussen, and Hanford.
Thank you. And please refer to the council member Cuddeback just stepped out and she's on her way back in. So she is here. Councilmember Davis is not here and we have not heard from him this evening. We'll go ahead and announce for the record when he comes in. And is anybody else missing? I think that's it. All right. So, Councilmember Rasmussen, will you go ahead and read some pledge?
Sure. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. First item that we have on the agenda this evening is an announcement. It's under announcements and presentations. This is a presentation from our Monroe and Snow Isle Library from Mr. Spirito.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
And hello to everybody.
Good evening.
That was just the library.
Well, I missed it tonight.
So, can I use this to advance?
That one's not connected to this computer, so just not an email.
You'll do it?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. So, welcome everybody. I just want to say thank you for having me back. It was almost 4 years ago that I moved here from Chicago and just almost immediately came and presented to you guys about a library that I barely knew. So I'm really excited to be back here to talk about the library. What I'm going to do here is I'm going to talk about the library in Monroe, a little bit about kind of the day in the life and what happens at our Monroe Library. Then I'm going to talk about the system, and then I'm going to talk about our upcoming levy. I'm going to do that as quickly as possible, hopefully in about 10 minutes. If you guys have any questions, we'll address it then. So, what happens at the Monroe Library? Well, if you look at this graph, which I just thought was kind of a fun graphic, this is just the day in the library and as far as visits go. So this is the number of visits at our branch of the Monroe Library. There's 23 libraries in Snow Isle's system, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But why I wanted to point out that number is that Monroe is one of the bigger libraries. There's 7 big libraries. We are number 5 as far as visits, checkouts, etc. So that's something to know, and as we know from what's going on up on the hill, this library is the right size for this community, finally. So when those people come, we're ready for them. So that's good to know. There's some other information on here. I want to bring your attention specifically to this number here. These are the number of children that participate in one program, which is our summer reading program. So that's just something good to know. And then down here, this is almost 5,000 preschoolers who attend our storytime programs that happen every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And right now, we've just added a STEAM program for preschoolers on Mondays. So what that means is 4 days a week in the morning, we have free programming for the children in our community. That STEAM program, by the way, is put on by the Imagination Children's Museum, and it's going on for 30 weeks. So every week for 30 weeks, which is awesome. So if you have preschoolers, or you know some, please send them my way. So, what are a few other things we need to know? Oh, wait, don't forward yet. So, the library is open 64 hours a week. That means every day we're open. When I got here, I wanted to take what was a library of books and materials and really turn it into a community center that also included, obviously, books, materials, databases, and all the other stuff that we kind of know from the library of old. We still have all that stuff, but now we're really about the community center. This is the only free and open building in our community that's available to and encouraged to have everybody there. Now, is it easy to walk, as I said to my wife last night? Well, what happened? I was a little discouraged yesterday morning. You know, we talk about our days. Well, you know, when I go to open the building and I see a five or six homeless people waiting to come in. Sometimes that can be a little discouraging. But at the same time, those are the people that I most want to come into our building. Now, does that mean that that's easy? No, it's not easy to manage a building where some of our most disadvantaged and some of our most advantaged use it, right? So that's the job of the library, is it's hard to give great customer service to everyone, right? And some of you may know what that's like, but it's hard to give customer service to somebody who's might have mental illness or is a challenging person to deal with, but that's the job that we have, and that's what I want to do, is make it available to everyone. So that's one of the things we do. Why don't we just go ahead one more? So I just want to talk about a few other things that that are benefits at our library. You know, we have a large meeting room that's available to be booked by any nonprofit in our community. And guess who uses that a lot? I bet nobody in this room would know that it's our homeowners associations who book this room weekly. And guess how many new homeowners associations are up there on the hill? No idea, but that's a lot of them. So, you know, these are great. This is a great resource for the community, that here's a meeting room that they can just book and use for their meetings, right? We also have a small study room that doesn't have the same policies attached to it. So local businesses use it for interviews, use it for small meetings. People are in there doing tutoring. That room is used 6 to 10 hours a day, depending on how long we're open. Sometimes it's booked all day long. So, you know, maybe the mayor might want to have the city administrator get out of the city hall, walk over there, and have a little meeting. You know, these are the kind of things that it gets used for, though. So, that's a thing. We also have a concierge service, which Noel calls Book a Librarian. And what that means is anybody in our community can call the library and book an hour-long appointment on anything, right? So what are some of the things that you might get a Book a Librarian for? Learning how to use your smartphone, learning how to use the digital resources of the library. One business member recently came to me and said, I'm starting a delivery service in Redmond, Duval, Monroe, blah, blah. You know, gave me 6 or 7 cities. So I went in, we had a session, I pulled the data based on salary from all of these communities with this by zip code. So then we went through and he said, oh, not those zip codes. It was obviously where the poorer people lives, because he wants to deliver to the rich people, right? So, you know, we were able to do this in a Book a Librarian appointment, where we were able to come up with an Excel spreadsheet of all the people in these communities that he could send a mailer to, right? So this is something that just happens in our community, and again, this is the way we want to support our small businesses. So I, at the library, and you guys might not know this, we have the same objectives as the city council and as the mayor. We want to develop small business in this community, and we want to support that. And that happens to also be one of Snow Isle's strategic priorities. So in the library system itself, we also want to build economic development. So where are we at here with my thing? Let's just look at this another second or so. So now we're talking a little bit more about the library system, right? So you can see this is, you know, almost 3.5 million. You can see the exponential this, etc. This is the number of all the children who are going to story times. And then this is a really interesting number, because we do every year a program called the Third Grade Reading Challenge. That's where third graders, because, you know, the data shows that third grade is where that's the challenging age, that if you're not good at reading at third grade, you're going to have a real challenge in the rest of your times. So Snow Isle does a program every year where third graders form teams, read books, and then have to challenge each other in these tournaments, basically, to see who wins. And then somebody ends up winning, one of the groups from one of these schools. But this is the amount of participation we have over Snohomish County. So we're working on 51 schools. Almost every elementary school in Monroe participates in this. So I think that's really amazing. Again, just to tell you about our strategic priorities for the whole library system: increasing kindergarten readiness in language and literacy, building civic engagement,
to address community issues, and strengthening our economy by supporting entrepreneurs and small business. And that's exactly what I was talking about a second ago. So again, so one more slide, please. SOAL has this mission. I think it's obviously very powerful. We want to be an open door. We are talking always about having no barriers. So there are very few things in the library that cost any money, but most of it is free. So the one thing is that we do charge for color printing, but we do give 70 pages of free printing a week. So, but anyways, you can see this. That's our mission. One more slide, please. So, and this is our purpose statement. And again, I don't need to go through these. This is all listed in your pamphlet if you want to see this, but I do want to be sensitive to your time because you guys got some studying to do, I know. One more slide, please. And again, this is our values. So you can see the importance here. And then if we go to the next one is... So now I just want to talk a little bit about the funding and how this levy is going to work. Now, I know you guys are much smarter than me when it comes to levies and bonds. I'm learning, and I'm going to do my best. But, you know, you guys can coach me if I'm a little off. But hopefully I'm doing all right. So as far as Snow Isle goes, and this is true for most companies, and I know some of your business people, and this is two different ways to look at it, but it's essentially the same here. The most of our budget goes towards our staff, right? So we have 500-plus employees. We have benefits, and that's the majority of our budget. The second biggest chunk is materials. So that's the buying of books and the buying of digital books and the paying for databases. So online databases where I got that data for our business owner, that costs some money. So you can see the resource usage here. And 98% of the funding, as I said. So state law says that, as we know, that the levy rate for the library right now is 38 cents. And we all know the calculation and how that would work. You know, if you're how much you're going to pay as a property owner. I'm not going to take the time to explain that to you guys. Next slide, please. So when we got ready to do and think about this levy, which we've been talking about for a couple years, we went out to the public to ask them. Our last levy was in 2009, right? So that was almost 10 years ago. We have been very careful about use our money and what we wanted to do. And so we actually, before we even went to the county to ask to put it on the ballot, we went and we did all this different surveying to get the information from the constituency to find out what they wanted. And really the question we asked them was, and I'll show you why don't we go forward in a minute. So
it's hard for me to talk without standing here. I like to point at things.
We do have a pointer.
Oh, really?
Oh,
okay. So the reality is that 10 years ago, in fact, it's this one, we were right here when we asked for 2000. No, we were right here. No, right here. Sorry. We were right here and we asked for that levy in 2009. And basically, it was a similar thing. We had gotten to a place where our reserves were running out, and this is where we're at now. So you can see when we got that levy in 2009, we were able to go forward, and in here, we were putting money away in our reserves. So we didn't go out and spend. We said we're going to grow gradually and use this money wisely. And so in that time, we put our money in reserve to say, okay, let's just wait and so that we don't have to go back to the voters for a long period of time. Well, in here, you can see that the inflation was starting to go up. And the cost of doing business is going up. And of course, we're growing in size because our communities are growing in size. So in here, we're starting to take out of our reserves, up here, we're using our reserves, and we've gotten to the end of that. So in 2019, we'll be out of our reserves. And what that means is, and that's what we asked the voters, we said, so, what do you want us to do? Either we have to go out and ask for the levy to be raised back to its original, not even quite to its original amount, or we have to cut services. Because we can't continue, because we have no reserves left, so we can't really continue on at that current rate. So, the voters unanimously told us that they would like us to put the ballot measure on, and that's, we went to our trustees and we asked them what they thought. They looked at the data and they decided that they would like to do it. We went to the county and they agreed and put it on the ballot. So now we have on April 24th this ballot measure that's coming up. So I would really like to encourage you all to get out and vote, and encourage anyone you else know to get out and vote as well. And that's pretty much the information I have. I can talk for a long time, but I want to be respectful to you guys. I think you guys all know about the work I do in the community and the work that the library and the position it places in the community. I want to continue to be a great community partner, and my wife and I are happy that we live in this community and we love this community. So that's really helped me to be passionate, not just about librarianship, but about my library in our town and your library in our town. So thank you. I went a little over, but do you guys have any questions?
Councilmember Scarborough. And before you begin, let the record show that Councilmember Davis in our chambers at 7:11 p.m.
Good. I have two questions. When you were talking about booking the library, the fellow who booked you to put together the spreadsheet, was there a cost to him?
No, there was not.
Okay. The other question I had, what do the disadvantaged use the library for?
That's a great question. So, a lot of people use the library for a cooling or a warming place. It's really, especially when it gets below 32 degrees, they leave the cold weather shelter and they come and wait to get in the library because it's very cold out. So that's what the disadvantage you're using it for. But the other thing is that our homeless population, as well as our low-income population, desperately need a computer that's connected to the internet. So we have 32 computers at our library in Monroe, which is sometimes not enough. So if you go in there in the afternoon, those computers, now a lot of those will be filled with kids playing Minecraft, if you know what that is. But there are, every single day, there are people applying for jobs, needing help with their resumes, filling out paperwork for their online, for their services. Because more and more, all services that disadvantaged people need to sign up for, and advantaged people, so it's all online, right? And you know, the interesting thing, and I didn't even say this, but one of the interesting things about the library now, the point being, and if you leave this meeting with one thing, it's the question of, what do we need libraries for? We have the internet. Well, have you guys heard about the internet these days? Have you heard about fake news? Have you heard about social media? Can you really find anything on the internet? You need a professional. You need us to help you with that, because we can tell you what's fake news, and we can help you find things that are the right things. We can help you find the health information that's the right thing. But more importantly, we can help that person who can barely use the computer.
That's what we need our grandkids for.
You know what, Kurt? The very interesting thing is, well, I'm not, I mean, I hear this on a daily basis also. I can't ask my kids to do it because they're so mean to me. So I don't know if you've heard, well, you're lucky, you got good grandkids. The other thing is, I was helping a guy today who was in his low 20s, right? He did not know how to use a computer, you know why? Because all he knew how to use was his smartphone. He didn't know how to, he could barely use the mouse. And that's what's happening a lot, is we have a lot of people who only know how to use their smartphone. And these are young people, right? You would think they would know how to use a computer, but they don't. So, I mean, this is a lot of what we do in the library on a daily basis. We have staff that's trained to just help people with the very basics of life. And that's what the library is, very important for that. Thank you for that question. Thank you.
Councilmember Kent.
Thank you. First, thank you for your service and your hard work at that library. I've been a library backer forever, and I think it's really an important part. And I think you've done a really good job, and I've heard nothing but kudos about the activities and the resources and the availability there. So first, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Can we go back one slide? I want to get some perspective here. So is this, you don't have any dates, or is this just based on, what's the time frame for these two charts?
So this chart right here is just basically showing this part right here.
Right, but I assume it's over a time period. I'm just trying to get some perspective. Are you running out of money within the next 2 days?
Oh,
within
well,
the next 9 months?
That's a great, that's more. And you know, honestly, this should have the years on it here down below, and I'd be glad, I'll just email you that as well. But really, what we're looking at is in 2019.
At that point, that represents 2019, so your reserve building this whole period, we're looking at about 10 years in terms of activity?
Yeah, from 2009, basically.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, that's all I really wanted.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Councilmember Cutback.
Yes, I want to thank you also. I love the library. When I first moved in this community in 2003, the library has always been a part of my life wherever I've lived. And so when I moved here in 2003, I was amazed that we had such a great library and have used it. Now my kids have gone through many stages and ages, and so we've used the library a lot. One question I had, I know that the Marysville library is really well known for having a database for grants and grant writing. Do we not have access to that at our Monroe Library, or?
So that's a good question. And there, you know, there's so much that I could talk about, really. I do want to be respectful, but. So that database that lives in Marysville is extremely expensive.
Okay.
And in fact, I mean, I can't predict it, but if we didn't continue, that may be some, you know, of the things that get cut. But that is, so basically to do that, you do need to go to Marysville to do that. But the other thing is, they have a librarian who's specifically trained on using that software. So it's great to make a book a librarian appointment with that person.
Right.
And then you can go there, and he can really tailor it. So you're not wasting time. And that's another thing about the library is,
yeah. We
really want, and I call it stalking customer service with my staff. I want my staff to jump on people when they come in the door and say, hi, can I help you? Because that's what, I don't want people to waste their time. You know, people really lose time in our community because of fooling around. I don't want you standing in a line. Like, if you come in my library and you're standing in a line, there's a problem, right? So we really have a customer service model that focuses on that circle, sort of. And so I went on a sidetrack, but
so Marysville.
Yeah.
And then one other question. So this is for me, like operations, obviously, for salaries and materials. Is there any plans in the future for any capital development at this library? Is that even in like a 10-year plan? Do you guys talk about that?
So right now, according to my boss and the higher ups at the service center, there our library, as you well, you know us, and you guys all know it as well, is about 15 years old right now. What that means is a lot of the furniture, we still have some furniture in there,
right.
It's 15 years old. We have a floor that really needs to be repaired. The building is so beautiful though, you think, oh, this is a perfect building, but there is, we hope in the future, but then again, that's another thing, you know, when you have an operational grant like this, it's those little projects that they get put off, right? So I know that for us, there's furniture, there's flooring, there's some other stuff that really needs to be addressed, and I hope that in the next few years that we're going to see that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Councilmember Rasmussen.
Thank you. Phil, I just wanted to echo a lot of the comments already. Thank you for coming and sharing the library with us, and I agree, it's definitely a great place and a great asset in our community. And you and I have partnered professionally numerous times, since we've both been here, or been in our current position. So, you know, the one question I did have, as I lifted my tag here, I found it, what happens if the voters say no versus what happens if they say yes in the threshold. So that explains that.
And I do, you know, they've already set up a meeting to talk with the managers of every building if it doesn't happen. So, you know, we have that meeting scheduled in March. Snowmile is very conservative about their money and how they spend it, so we're very careful. And that's really why we've been able to go so long before asking for another levy lit lift. So, you know, we're really hoping that this works out, but we'll also have a contingency plan if it doesn't. And, you know, it just means that if that doesn't pass, we'll just work all the harder to keep giving as much of the same service as we can.
Excellent, thank you. And just one more comment, throw out a plug for the book librarian service that is offered. That is fantastic. Used it numerous times with Emily over there, so
that's great. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you very much, Mr. Spirit.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
We'll be.
I won't stick around for your study session.
The next item we have on our agenda this evening is public comments. This is a time set aside for members of the audience, for members of the public to speak to the City Council on any issue related to City of Monroe, except any quasi-judicial matter that is subject to public hearing. There is a sign-in sheet. Nobody signed in. Is there anybody who would like to report to speak to the City Council this evening? Okay, seeing none, we'll go ahead and move on to the next item on the agenda, which is council member reports. Are there any council member reports this evening? Okay, seeing none.
How about a council member question?
That works.
Okay. Go for it.
Council member Kent?
We have what's the water fund?
What's the water fund?
Water operating or no, water?
What is this? I was asked what the water fund was, and I have no idea. So I thought I would ask everybody. Those are the words I heard, water and pump.
Well, there are two. Okay. I'll introduce them and then let Becky fill them in. So there's the water operating fund, which is used to operate the water system. We have a conveyance system, so we hire our water from the City of Everett. So it's to purchase water and then to convey that water around to the residents and businesses who live in the community. And there's also a water capital fund, which is what we use and set aside money to repair and replace and improve the water conveyance system, so the tanks and the pipes and the ground.
Maybe this will clarify a little bit. This is in regard to a fee or a penalty that someone had to pay. They were told that the money goes into a water fund.
So I'm assuming that must be the water operating fund.
Yeah, so basically the water fund, in a more generic sense, is just the accounting that's associated with the business-like activities of our water utility. And so if someone's paying a penalty, that means that the rate that they are paying for using water, they've paid it late.
Right.
And so the penalty then becomes another revenue stream that goes into towards water operation.
Okay, so it goes into quote a water general fund. It's not a specific
right.
water fund that is isolated and used for a special purpose.
No. It's used for the operations of the water utility.
Okay, so it sounds like it's more of just a translation issue. This is what they're told from this. They have confusion, so do I.
Right, just keep in mind that your water fund and your other utility funds mm-hmm. are enterprise funds, meaning that the revenue that are raised has to stay within those funds, so as opposed right. to the general fund, which mm-hmm. somebody else might have heard.
So the fees aren't going, like I just said, the fees aren't going into the general fund, they're going to water specifically. Is it water or utilities? So
it's water utility specific.
Well, what I mean is it's just going to be used for water, so it's going to be for sewer.
Just water. The sewer has its own separate fund.
Okay, good. Thanks for clearing that up.
Are there any other comments or questions from council members? All right. Department reports. Do we have any department staff reports this evening? We've only got a couple of department directors here. Brad, do you have anything? Other disasters before you present, do you have anything?
No.
Okay. And then for city administrative reports,
The only thing I have is just a quick overview of the upcoming agenda, and note that on the March 6th meeting, we had tentatively scheduled a purchase and sale agreement for the North Kelsey property, and we're still waiting for comments back from the purchaser on the purchase and sale agreement, so that's been moved off to March
28th. Okay. Any questions for our city administrator? All right, seeing none, you'll see that Monroe this week is in the packets, and I will be doing copy with her this Saturday, and then I also received word that the Monroe Coalition is putting on a program of tickets next week about violence in our community or something along those lines. Councilmember Hanford, do you have something on this?
I'm sorry, I just noticed that on next week's schedule you have me down to give the legislative affairs update, but I'll be absent that night.
So okay.
Just so you know. Thanks.
Thank you. So when I get more information about the item that I just referenced, I'll make sure that that gets sent out to you. And I think that's all I got. So we're going to move on to discussion item seven. We're going to move on to discussion item number one. This is AB 18-056 presentation, City of Monroe investment information from Ms. Hassard. Ms. Hassard.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So tonight, I'm actually going to turn it over to our expert, Mr. Paul Jarvis. He is the Managing Director with Sign Value Investment, and he is our broker that assists us with our longer-term investment. And just as a side note, Paul and I have actually been known each other through work for quite a number of years, so from his time before Time Value Investment. So he is a well-known entity here in the state of Washington, very well trusted with regards to investments, and quite frankly, has a lot of municipal clients because of this. So hopefully I didn't steal any of your time.
No, that's really wonderful. Thank you.
Boy, I didn't know libraries would be so exciting. That was an incredible presentation. And Deborah, we've known each other.
Yes.
You were in Stanford, weren't you?
And prior to that in Sultan, and before that in Woodenville. So,
Yeah,
it's been around a while.
Across a few times. Okay, well, thank you very much for having me out. Becky and the entire City Council. The intent tonight, there really isn't an agenda in terms of trying to persuade you to do anything. I just want to make you guys current on what the city has been doing with their public fund investing for a number of years, per Becky's request. Oh, good, this is working great. I'll give you some quick background about myself. I got an MBA back in 1988 from Indiana University, and came back to Washington. I was born in Yakima, so I was thrilled to come back to Washington and started a firm called Reagan McKenzie. They've since been purchased by Wells Fargo. But my first account in this business back in 1988 was a City of Tenino. Nancy Gratias, check the record. She was the finance director back in 1988. And that's kind of when I learned that public entities were potential investment clients. And so I got excited about public entities and never really looked back. I was with Reagan McKenzie for a year, then moved to U.S. Bank, and I was in the U.S. Bank's bond department for 12 years. Most of that as a vice president. I then moved to Piper Jaffray, was there for 7 years as managing director in their bond department with a focus on public entities, primarily in Washington State. And then roughly 8 years ago, joined Time Value Investments as managing director. So I've worked with a lot of public entities in the state. TVI covers over 300 public entities in the western states, over 150 in the state of Washington. When I say covers, that means we assist them with their public funds investing, much like we do for Monroe. I've worked with Monroe, City of Monroe, for over 10 years and assisted the city with their public funds investing. Let's turn to the booklet, if we can, and go to page 2. Yeah, page 2. And to get started, this is a graph of, as it says, the 3-year U.S. Treasury note since February 17, 2009, so the last 9 years. And we use a 3-year Treasury note because it's really easy to measure. It's on everybody's Bloomberg, and you can go to yahoo.com and see the yield on a 3-year Treasury note. And 3 years is kind of the range of public entities tend to invest, 2 and 3 years. So if the 3-year Treasury note is at its highest point in 9 years, that means that Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the kind of bonds that Monroe tends to use for their investments are probably also at their 9-year highs, as are most of those short-term government agency type products. So this just kind of gives you some perspective for about where yields are today and where they've been. As you can see, we've come a long ways in the last few years.
So, you know, we're at 9-year highs, and that's nothing but good news. So I thought I'd make you aware of that. Now, if you go to page 3, this I just cut and pasted from the RCWs that govern public funds investing. And I wanted to just show you that allowable investments for public funds in the state of Washington are these federal agencies, federal home loan bank notes and bonds, etc. And then it goes on to say other government-sponsored corporations whose obligations are or may become eligible as collateral, etc., etc. All this, and frankly, there's a very similar language in the investment policy for the city of Monroe. So that's what we use to kind of, you know, find securities that might work for the city of Monroe. Now, if we go to page 4, this is a copy, as it says there, the city of Monroe's current bond portfolio. It's really pretty much as simple as it looks. If you look down the security description column, those are all government agency securities. In fact, I think we go into detail on that. We do on page 5. But we can see, anything good work there? I don't think it works on TV. Interesting. Anyway, these are all federal agency products, all of which comply with the RCW 39.59040. And then the next page, you can see that the maturities are all very well diversified. A real advantage that this city has, over even some of the larger cities, is that the city has invested only in federal products. You know, either obligations that are directly backed by the United States Treasury or are backed by an agency of the federal government. Those products have never in the history of this country defaulted. They've ever been laid on a payment.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Okay. I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but could you just explain weight regarding?
Sure. That's the percentage of the portfolio that each of those securities make up.
So the first case, you first said it's 3.8% of our entire portfolio?
Correct. That's right. That's it.
All in.
Yep. So the city has 100% federal products, either backed by the United States Treasury or backed by an agency of the federal government. That's as safe as a product can get. And so there's no real reason to get fancy about trying to diversify between the federal agencies that I can see. We have no reason to expect the United States Treasury is any more inclined to back Fannie Mae than it is Federal Home Loan Bank. You already have the best products that frankly are available on this planet for fixed income products. So the diversification between the various federal agencies is not a lot of value that's going to be gained. However, in view of the fact we have no idea what interest rates are going to be a year from now, or even a month from now. You know, frankly, the Trump election changed everything. If you can see that kind of, if you look back on page 2, look at, let me just take you back there. Right here, this is the result of the election. It's about November 8, or whatever the date was when the election was. Rates just kind of took off. Now, since that point, there's been this kind of slow grind upward as the economy has improved, but this sort of changed the whole trend, this kind of slog back and forth when Trump got elected. And it's not really clear as to how it is that Trump being elected pushed up rates. I mean, there's been a lot of talk afterwards about, well, he's going to, you know, expand the economy, etc. But in any case, at the time, it wasn't totally clear. But the point there is that changes in interest rates are utterly unpredictable. At least it's been my experience in 30 years I've been doing this. And so to protect an investor, a fixed income investor, against the random changes in investments, we pay a lot of attention to this maturity date column. You want that staggered. We didn't know back in January 30, 2014, I assume Diane was here then, when this security was purchased, we didn't know that interest rates would be about 100 basis points higher than they were at the time, right? But we just staggered maturities here just in case interest rates were a lot higher at this point than they were at that point. And so we try to stagger our maturities because of the inherently unpredictable nature of interest rates. That is a real risk. The risk of these guys defaulting isn't real. I mean, we haven't seen it. You know, I guess anything's possible. The sky can be purple tomorrow. But in fact, federal products have been utterly consistent performers. But man, interest rates are scary because they can change so quickly. So it's important that we stagger maturities as has been done here. You know, and so it's going to work to the city's advantage, but there's a whole bunch of 18 maturities because, you know, through the luck of just luck, interest rates are a lot higher, and you guys will be participating in new higher rates if you choose to reinvest those maturities. All right, now then, let's go to page 6 or 7. This is kind of interesting. I thought I would just grab a couple securities that would be classics for the City of Monroe portfolio whenever you choose to invest, if you choose to. You notice this portfolio is a little lean in 19. You got a bunch of 18s, we have two in 19. Now, you're not that lean because you got a whole bunch in December of 18, $4 million there. I mean, 15% of the portfolio approximately. And then also, you've got a pretty big slug right here, $2 million, but on January of 20. But still, it wouldn't hurt to have another 19. So, if today were investment day for the City of Monroe, what I'd be calling in and suggesting probably something like this, consider something that's like this bond, 415 19 Federal Farm Credit Bank, yields 1.92%. The issuer, Federal Farm Credit Bank, has the right to pay it off early if they choose. If they do, the yield will be something higher than 1.92, but this bond is not on track to be paid off before maturity because the semi-annual interest payment is so low. Right now, rates are not low enough that they can refinance that 1.19. That's what makes it called a bond, right? Because they can issue a new bond below 1.19. Well, that doesn't live there right now. So based on where interest rates are today, this bond is going to go to 425.19 and yield 1.92. Well, that's a pretty nice fit for a portfolio that's lean in 19. Was it April 19 we just looked at? Yeah, April 19. You can see that was snuggled in here quite nicely. And you might think, well, gee, that seems awfully simple. That's right. This is simple. There's no rocket science that makes this go round. Sorry. Except Becky's a genius. But in any case, choosing maturities, really the first thing you try to do is flush out your ladder as much as you can. Now, the next one that I thought would be a good fit for you guys is the Federal Farm Credit Bank 199. That's a big enough semi-annual interest payment that that's very refinanceable in this environment. Not immediately. It's got several years left to go, 3 years and a few months left to go. But when this becomes like a one-year bond, hey, one-year rates are below 1.99. Six-month rates are below 1.99. So assuming interest rates stay right where they are is sort of a starting point for our discussion. If today this bond had 6 months left to go, the Federal Farm Credit Bank would be incented to issue a new bond at the six-month rate, which is below 1.99, pay this one off. The bond's at a fairly substantial discount. Investors spent $990,228 for a bond that's going to get paid off at $1 million. There's an additional $10,000 along with the 1.99. That will make the yield higher than 2.31 if it gets called for maturity. So if the security is paid off before maturity, and this security is on track for that based on today's rates, that could change tomorrow morning. So the security is not on track to go to maturity, it's on track to be called sometime prior to that, and the yield would be higher than 2.31. Worst case, if interest rates go up above 1.99 for all maturities, then the issuer is never going to refinance that. The bond proceeds to maturity and pays 2.31. This bond's an interesting fit for your portfolio also. Oh, I'm sorry, I lost maturity. 5.321, going the wrong way. And 5.321 is longer than your 1.15.21, which is your longest bond right now. So that bond would be a natural next run on the ladder if you wanted to go a little further out. Okay? So that's really kind of the science that goes on behind trying to find securities that match your portfolio. That's the number one thing. Try to find securities that kind of fit in. And then from there, we look at the call feature. Is it likely to be called? And that kind of stuff. But we keep it within the federal range.
So if I may interject here, so one of the things that we do internally is as I'm not sure if you guys saw, the next bond we have maturing is in April. Right. So when that comes up, one of the things that we do internally is we look at what our cash flow needs are going to be over the next 3 to 4 year horizon. We'll look at what debt service we have out there, what kind of cash that we think is coming in. That's where having the 5 year forecast is going to be helpful as well, to then determine, do we have should we reinvest that $1 million, or are we going to need it for cash flow? Because if I need it in 2 years, I don't want to buy a 4 year bond, obviously, because I don't want to incur any penalties when the cash is needed. We also keep a certain amount in short term investments for some of those cash needs as well. So the other thing we will look at is if we don't need to have $1 million in, say, the next 4 year horizon, and then maybe because sales tax has been coming in higher than anticipated, we may even look at investing a little bit more. But we definitely, that's some of the things that we look at internally, and then I'll take a look at what our maturity dates are to try to maintain the diversity out there, and take advantage of the fact that right now interest rates are moving upwards. So there's a little bit that goes on internally as well beyond just, and then Paul's real good about, I'll tell him what my needs are and what kind of horizons we're looking at, and then he usually is good about giving me at least 3 options to take a look at, and then we'll discuss by phone before we make a decision.
Is there a question?
Councilmember Cutback?
Yeah, just looking at the the dates and so how do you determine whether to do, do a two or a four? I mean, I know what you were saying about cash flow, but your like process you go through, do you look at what the interest rates, what, I mean, how do we know whether we should do a 4 year or 2 year? I don't see any 1 years up there.
Well, you've got it in 1 year now, right? It's, I mean, that's like 2 months from now. You know what I'm saying?
Right, but if we got that bond in 2014, so we've had it, when it matures, it'll be 4 years, yes. Right? So how do you determine for us whether, if we were to reinvest that, whether we do it for a year, 2 years, 4 years, what criteria do you look at?
I'll just add one thing, and Becky might weigh in on this too, but back in 14, interest rates were so painfully low, you look at that graph on page 2 earlier,
yeah.
That, you know, go out 1 year, it'd be like, you know, 0.12%
right.
or something. So when rates were that low, a lot of investors were going out a little bit further just to try to bring some yield out. Now, it's more interesting now, isn't it?
Right.
That's one of the fun things about this whole business, is because you have this changing yield environment.
Would
yield
you do rate. A year?
Yeah.
Today's market.
What do you say, you might do a year?
Well, would we?
Oh, well, you know, again, I would probably hit the gap if you wanted to go short, you know, right in here. Because there's a natural spot there for a bond, right? I mean, 1 year would put us, well, I guess 1 year would put us about there, wouldn't it? February 19, we were looking at
right.
April 19 a moment ago.
Right.
So that seems, like a reasonable investment in this environment. Another thing we would look at is the difference in yield between a longer security.
Right.
This is 1.92 for about a year and 2 months, 2.31 for 3 years and change. That seems reasonable. So it doesn't look like you're getting ripped off by going out a little bit longer. You're still being paid for it. So there's no obvious kind of answer there. If the yield curve, as they call it, gets real flat, where a 1 year looks like a 5 year, then it becomes more complicated.
Right.
Because then, think of 2004, 2005, everything was at 5%. The 2 year bonds were 5%, money market funds were 5%, and 5 year bonds were 5%. It was very tempting in those days to buy just leave your money market funds at 5%. But do you remember what happened in 06, 07? Those rates dropped off a cliff, you know? And that's why, in my opinion, it's really hard for any of us, those of us that do this all day long, any of us, to try to predict interest rates and make choices based on the yield structure at that time. Because we're just not going to outsmart the guys in New York. They've already positioned themselves based on what Jerome Powell said today and their speculation about the future. So, generally speaking, I normally advise customers to look at their portfolio and just fixate on this and what their needs are, as opposed to trying to position themselves in advance of some kind of hope for interest change, because the market's already positioned for that. And the information we have is inferior to what those guys positioned on 2 weeks ago, in my opinion. But we're here to serve, so you can tell us where you want to be. But
right.
That's normally what we'll recommend.
But to take that further again, it gets back to looking at what our cash needs are going to be,
right.
How long we can comfortably have it invested, because as Paul kind of alluded to, rule of thumb is if you can go out a little bit longer, you can get a better yield.
Right.
I also look at what's coming up to what will mature in the next year, so that if interest rates do continue to go even higher, I'm still going to have opportunity with the new maturities to capture that as well. So that gets back to doing the diversification based on due dates, maturity dates, and not necessarily
yield.
Exactly.
Yeah, your cash needs are obviously the king, and I have no information as it relates to
yeah.
that. So I would defer to Becky every time. She said, I got to be 1 year, I better be finding 1 year bonds, I guess. Okay, now then. So there's a couple of bonds that would fit nicely into your existing portfolio. This is interesting. I would be very interested in this if I was this group, because, you know, how does money get paid these gigantic increments? You guys are purchasing $1 million bonds. Well, do you wire funds to TDI and hope for the best, or how does that work? Well, there is a delivery versus payment process. GFOA is Government Finance Officers Association. It's like the big organization for public entities nationwide. And they have a lot of best practices they developed. And one of them is delivery versus payment. This is how a transaction gets done by City of Monroe and the State of Washington, the City of Seattle. All the big players do this. There's no wire that comes to the provider. If Becky and I agree on a security, and she says, Paul, I'd like bond number 3 or 4 on your list, so go get $1 million of that, we'll go buy that security. They most send a confirmation to City of Monroe that shows the security she specifically requested. And then she'll sign that confirmation and forward it to U.S. Bank and also send the money to U.S. Bank. That's where your security is being held. In a third-party, completely independent account, where I have no access, or firm has no access to it. No one does except for City of Monroe.
And then Kathy Meyer at U.S. Bank will receive that confirmation sent by an authorized party from City of Monroe. They'll check. You know, is Becky Hassard authorized? Yes. Okay, Becky Hassard wants this security in the City of Monroe account. And then when we go to deliver the security, that security will be matched against the confirmation that your authorized party signed. If they match, then that security gets accepted into your account. If they don't match, it gets rejected back to us. If it does get accepted into your account by U.S. Bank, and they charge for this process, but it's $40. My mind is it's by nominal. U.S. Bank charges $40 to oversee the transaction, ensure the right bond comes in that matches the confirmation that was submitted. If it does match, then they accept the bond, and then funds are released once they've taken positive possession. So that protects you against shysters that might not ever send the bond in, and also against human error. There's a lot of bonds going everywhere all the time. I remember once we had an issue with Idaho County and San Juan County. You know, both counties bought a security from us, so San Juan County seems like Idaho County. If you're not really hit to what those counties are called up there. And so I think it was Idaho County's bond went to San Juan County, some goofy thing. That kickback would turn around. So U.S. Bank oversees the transaction and ensures that the right security comes in before funds are released. And again, it costs $40, but again, a nominal fee. One other thing I'll point out about your safekeeping arrangement, a lot of banks can safekeep. Normally, the big banks will want to safekeep in their trust department. If you've ever been in a trust department, I used to work at U.S. Bank, I go to the trust department occasionally, and it's always like mahogany and leather, and can we get you some water, sir, that kind of thing. You know, it's a very high margin kind of business. And they charge like it for safekeeping. Yeah. Thousands of dollars per year to safekeep for public entities. Some public entities just pay that fee. U.S. Bank has a trust department. They also have a separate safekeeping department that has nothing but safekeeping. That's what you guys are using. And this is all cubicles in back in Minneapolis. I've been there. And those guys are not overly friendly. They don't care what your kids' names are. They're just like kicking out bonds every day. And the fees look like it. It's $20 a month plus $2 a bond. If you want to get like 10, 12, 15 bonds even, 2 times 15 is 30, plus 20, $50 a month. I bet that's the range we're in, isn't it? $50 a month and $40 to oversee a bond. You can sell a bond for months, so that $40 a month thing is not happening very often. So you're paying something like $50 a month for full-on professional third-party safekeeping, complete ability versus payment at U.S. Bank. Great value, and it keeps your, by keeping your cost down, it keeps your deals up.
And if I can add to that, one of the other things that we started this last year is we opened what's called a municipal investment account with U.S. Bank. So, because what we were finding before is when they were paying interest on these bonds that we were holding, they would wire that to our local bank keeping, we'd have to pay a water fee on both sides, versus then opening this MIA account with U.S. Bank, they just deposit it in there, no wire fee. And then when the bonds come mature, they just now deposit the money into this MIA account, and then they can pull it right out of that account if I reinvest. And again, no wire fees versus before, we were paying $30 a pop both each way when we were making these investments because we had the wire between banks.
It's a great upgrade because that account's collateralized by U.S. Bank. So in other words, you have a maturity that goes to your municipal investor account and sits there in this U.S. Bank account. $250,000 is federally insured. The rest of it is fully collateralized by U.S. Bank. And they are sensitive. They don't like putting up that collateral, but they do.
And actually, when I figured out, because they're also good every month when they send me my report on what is being held in our safekeeping account, it gives me a schedule of when all the investment payments or interest payments are going to be made throughout the year. I counted those up at $30 a pop. By opening this MIA account, we're going to save close to $500 this year alone in just wire fees that we're no longer paying. So.
Well, this is a question for Becky. So where does the interest go? Does it go in
the, So we deposit it first into the general fund, and then at the end of the month, when I get the interest earnings from the local government investment pool, as well as our money market at Opus Bank, then the system actually has an algorithm in it for me that I tell it how much we had throughout the whole month, and then it will distribute among all the funds that the city has, including the utility funds, based on how much cash, what their cash position was at the end of each month. So it is prorated across all the funds, making the assumption that each fund's cash is what's earning this interest. But it goes back to operations.
Okay.
So money earned by the water utility operating fund goes back into the water.
Yeah.
And then the last couple points is a little, I want to point out a class that we teach once a year. This is sort of self-sponsored by TVI. So the fourth year we've taught this class. It's called Public Funds Investments Made Easy. We had mayors come and council members, and you certainly are welcome. It's free. It's on Thursday, March 29th, from 10 to 2:30 at the Linwood Convention Center. Literally, we have 71 signed up for our, this is our fourth run of it. And we have people coming from out of state. We certainly would welcome you. Just let me know if you'd like to come. We'll put your name on the list and have a badge ready for you and lunches provided, et cetera, et cetera. But that's a popular class. It starts out at the kindergarten level and kind of introduces you to bonds from the ground up. And then the last screen is just shows that in the Puget Sound area, there's 64 public entities that purchase securities through TBI, much like Monroe has been doing, throughout the state, 150 and 300, over 300 in the western states. What other questions might have come up as I phrased through that?
Any other questions?
Good. All right. Councilor Gamble, I've seen many financial presentations. You actually made that very enjoyable.
So glad to have it.
They come to the class.
Yeah. Love to have it. You ready to make a question? Get dismissed.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Next item that we have on the agenda this evening is discussion item number two.
So just a question about the, so Becky, you included the investment policy in the packet, so are we going to be discussing that at any time, or is that going to be finance, or, because it hasn't been
tweaked in a few years.
Yeah.
So tonight's presentation, if you remember, was a result of council asking, just wanting to learn a little bit more about what we do with investment. Ms. Knight had a great idea of including the investment policy as part of the packet. The plan is to at least give it a look later on this year so that if it does need any type of updating, it would be a good time to do that. The reality is the RCWs haven't changed a whole lot, and Paul has actually looked at it for me, and he said the bulk of it there is still real good, so it may not need updating. Long answer for your easy question is yes, we will look at it this year, but there's a potential it's probably good as it is.
Do we have a kind of a system or a process where we know when to kind of look at policies? You know, something that... You know, you look at them once a year, twice, you know, every 2 years, when, you know, some kind of process. We have so many policies. You can see where you might have some policies that kind of get forgotten and don't ever get looked at or updated. And then, you know, some kind of process around how do we, what sets it in place to review a policy. I mean, that's kind of throughout government, you know.
I'm not aware of any kind of best management practices. Have you seen anything specific?
I haven't anything specific. I think it depends on each department and how quickly things might change there. Being newer here, one of the first things I wanted to do was review all the policies associated with finance, and that's why with Deborah's help and the mayor's blessing, there are a couple policies we will be working with the finance and HR committee with this year, and then there's a couple that as state law changes, we update them accordingly at that time.
Right.
But there's no real, at least not that I've ever seen, a benchmark as far as how often you look at them.
Yeah. And Councilor, there are some things that are, I mean, even getting to our administrative section of code, the development regulations are an example of something a little bit above those administrative things where sometimes they're boring things, but when you get new staff that comes in, that's a great opportunity to look at things. So. That's one of the things that I like that Ms. Hassler is doing this night is we're reviewing those policies and seeing what needs to be updated. One of the things that we've talked about on the staff level is also looking at some of our administrative sections of actual code and seeing what we might need to make updates there too.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right, anything further, everybody? Mr. Feilberg.
Thank you.
So the city of Monroe has looked for several years about quiet zones, and it's recently come to our attention that it may not be as difficult as previously thought. So the number one thing to remember is that the establishment of a quiet zone does not guarantee no train horns, but it should limit their use. And why it says that, the subtitle is train noise reduction zone rather than quiet zone. Because if there's somebody parked on the tracks, they still get the bulletin horn. Yeah. So basically, the establishment of a quiet zone is predicated on not decreasing the safety, the crossings in the quiet zone, as opposed to having the trains blow their horns. This is done by calculating the risk index with horns, which is what the current conditions are, and then comparing that with the quiet zone risk index. And if the quiet zone risk index is less than the risk index with horns, a quiet zone could be established. And the Federal Railroad Administration has an online tool that you put in the information about the crossings, and they come up with the risk index with horns, and you tell them what improvements you want to do, and they come up with a quiet zone risk index, and you see if the two are cool. And then the things that work into what the risk factors are is the train speed, the traffic volume, and then also the number of lanes, and then what kind of protection you have at the crossing. Yes?
Number of lanes of traffic?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And also the number of cracks, too.
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
So both are taken into account. Yes. So there are two ways to establish a quiet zone. One is the public authority designation, which the public authority is either the City of Monroe or, for Lewis Streets, the Washington State Department of Transportation, because they're in charge of that road. We can establish a quiet zone if any of three conditions are met. One is that we have supplementary safety measures at all the crossings. The risk index with the quiet zone index is less than the national threshold, which is a very small number, so that's hard to do. And then the other one is to lower your quiet zone risk index to less than the risk index of horns. If that doesn't work, you can have the public authority can apply to the Federal Railroad Administration to have them look at some other things you can do, which are called alternative safety measures, which aren't up to as effective as the supplementary safety measures, and then they determine if you meet the criteria. The only problem with that is that it takes, we'd have to hire somebody who knows how to rate rail crossings in order to come up with that number to give them the information to do that. So there's several different kinds of supplementary safety measures. The first is closing the crossing. This is what City of Vancouver did for one of their quiet zones. It's basically the road used to go across there. They made big, nice curves. Cars don't go across there, so there's no conflict, so that's very safe.
That's an option.
Center one is grade separation, also in the City of Vancouver. In that case, they went under the railroad tracks. This is part of their $40 million redevelopment of the waterfront on the Columbia River.
That made a lot of people in Monroe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another one is do four quadrant gates. So you can see at this end, there's the two gates on the front side, and there's also two gates on the back side, so people can't drive around the gates because it blocks the entire street.
We have pretty much all that.
No, we have two quadrant gates. We only have the one. You can't. Yeah, you have going, not on the other side.
We don't have any four quadrant.
No. Yeah. And then the other one is a non-traversable curb, which is basically a 6-inch high square curb that you put down in the middle. So if someone comes in here and says, oh, look, the arms are down, I'm going to go around, they can't go over the bump. And the...
Is that in addition to the...
No.
Instead of
four quadrants, yeah. Gotcha. And then there's also, this is called mountable medians with reflective traffic control devices from the City of Washougal. So basically, it's kind of like the things we have on Kelsey Street to keep you from going across at Clinton Place.
Right.
So the idea being is someone gets here and they say, oh, I don't want to wait for that, and it says, don't jump over them and go out. The thing about the two the transversible median, non-transversible medians and the mountable medians is that the standard is 100 feet from the intersection, or actually from where the crossing arm comes down, but you can shorten that down to 60 feet if there's like an intersection or a driveway, but there can be no commercial driveways within 60 feet of the crossing. Which you'll see there's a problem with that. So there are quiet zones in Washington. There's Washougal, Pinell, White Salmon, Stevenson, two in Vancouver, Spokane Valley, and Mukilteo. So those are the ones that did one of these safety measures in order to get them, or did the alternative safety measures. And then the Seattle and Wenatchee has what's called pre-rule quiet zones, which are quiet zones that existed prior to 2005, that they had come to some arrangement with the railroad before the federal law went into effect, and they were allowed to keep those.
Councilor McKeon.
Thank you. So I'm just curious, based on the relatively small size of Monroe, is there any distance between crossings that you'd have to maintain?
It has to be at least a half a mile.
How far apart are crossings?
Less than that. And also, you can't have another crossing within a quarter of a mile that's outside the quiet zone. So basically, we have to do them all.
Okay.
So, the North Quiet Zone.
I'm sorry, but one follow-up on that. But you said Lewis Street is not under our jurisdiction?
Right, and we already talked to Washington State Department of Transportation. They're happy to help us fill out the paperwork with their name on the bottom of it to get that one done, too.
So, effectively, we can do them all?
Yes.
Okay.
Sounds great. So, there are five public crossings in the city of Monroe. Only three of them are arranged to allow for the use of the low-cost supplementary safety measures.
Which is the...
The reflectorized, the mountable median with reflectorized traffic control devices. First one is Main Street. The purple is the 100 feet of something blocking it. The line across is the 60 foot mark. So there's three interesting places on that. This one is, if you go the full 100 feet, it would be very hard to make a left turn out of Railroad Avenue without driving down the wrong side of the street. Even if you drop it off to the 60 feet, it's kind of iffy on that. This one here, you're going to be able to make a left turn out of Butler onto West Main Street, or East Main Street. And then this that's the driveway back to the railroad shop behind what used to be GNS Heating. It's outside the 60, so we just had to shorten that one up, and it's okay to have that one, even though we kept the left.
Everybody oriented there?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Lewis Street, same thing. There'll be no left turns out of the back of this is best north is that way. It used to be the big box. Big box thing, which is going to be the hot yoga studio. This is the Playa Cafe. I used to point you, but it doesn't reflect off of the glass screen. So left turns out of that would be a problem, and then this driveway here, since it serves a commercial property, would have to be closed. And then people do occasionally, I'm not sure where they work, but they park in there, so that would be an issue.
But it's a load and unload forum, so that goes into Elite Sports.
Yeah.
That's their delivery.
Right.
Councilor Scarborough?
Does that limit what we might want to do at this property with the... the empty property up to the top right?
No. No, because they... If they can turn out, they can turn right because you can't go across it because the left turns out. You don't go in the wrong way.
And anything for the customers?
No.
Okay. And just to be clear, this is just with the preferred curve, the vertical curve.
Yes.
If you were to do the four quadrant as an example, that would be one way to treat the without closing the access.
Correct. Yes. Okay.
Councilor Hinsberg.
Thank you. Could you just clarify what you said? That driveway would have to be closed. Could you clarify that whole scenario again?
Basically, we have to get rid of it, take out the pressed sidewalk and make it a full sidewalk with a curb.
Because it's within 60
feet. Because it's within the 60 feet.
So then the deliveries would not be allowed.
Right. Yeah. But we'll talk about there's ways around that.
Isn't there access to that in the back?
Yes, there is. It just depends on which, because the building's kind of strangely chopped up inside, so it just depends on what they're taking and how they get them there.
So on the upside, the yoga place there might benefit from not having a meeting or training room. If you're doing yoga, you may not want to hear a train, right?
Yeah, right.
But on the downside, you wouldn't be able to turn left out of there with this.
Right. And the only person who really uses that, that I've seen on a regular occasion, is the Romac manufacturing in Sultan that comes and unloads metal, scrap metal off the trains there. They have a dump truck comes in and do that. So they'd have to make a different route. Yeah.
Councilmember Gamble?
And the only reason why that one doesn't get shut down is because the line goes a quarter of the way through that, right?
No, because you can come in, you come out and you hit a gate.
Got it.
So that you can make a right turn out. You hit the gate. Just if you make a left turn out here, you can drive across the tracks and it's like, oops.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow. That's the point.
You're assuming you're going to turn left out of the driveway.
Yeah, and there's no place for us to go, so we have to drive up the wrong side of the road, and then there's no gate. We get T1 by a train.
Right.
Because they're not blowing their horn, and we didn't know they were there.
Okay, cool. All right, continue.
This is Kelsey Street. Once again, north is to the Falcon. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
Starting with this one is Blueberry. The intersection, it's actually more than 60 feet, so we're okay there. There is an issue with the trucks from State Roofers. Once a week, they have a very large truck comes, and it may run over the end of that, which would be increased cost because they probably break the little delineator things. There would be no left turns out of here. But we've already talked about that in our previous discussions about doing about putting curb across there, so that probably doesn't make a difference. The only one is this. That would not be, we were talking about making that a right in, right out. That would have to go away completely. Mm-hmm. So the only entrance to Rite Aid would be off of Highway 2. So those are the three that are qualified for the supplementary safety measures, if we do those other things. And then the last two, 179th, there's no driveways close to it, but you do not have either 100 or 60 feet before you run into Highway 2.
Right.
So you don't qualify as a supplementary safety measure. And then same thing with Friends Boulevard, is that's not 60 feet long. Mm-hmm. So taking all that into account, plugging it into the computer program that they have on the line. The risk index with horns is 31,000, and the quiet zone risk index using those three intersections with the mountable median with reflectorized traffic control devices is 25,000, so it qualifies.
Ms. May?
So, the other one, if you don't want to close the driveway or something like that, it's possible to, since we don't meet the definition of a supplementary safety measure, we can apply to the Federal Railroad Administration and say it's an alternative safety measure, and then they can go through the process of approving that after we have some rail expert tell us what the enhancement factor is. So all these measures have ratings on them that you do math and it comes in, it reduces the risk by this much. So we have to figure out what the not having or being allowing people to make a left turn into the oncoming train, you know, what is that factor that you do to see if you can get your ratings lower than the risk index reforms.
Councilmember Kidd?
Thank you. So I'm just curious, is it just the noise of the horns, or is it also, are they allowed to be faster through town?
No, this does not affect the speed.
Does it affect speed?
It just says that they don't blow their horns on a regular basis.
Mr. Fowler, who sets the speed going through town?
We're not sure. I think it's the federal rail. It's probably the UTC in conjunction with the FRA. So the Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission, along with the Federal Railroad Administration.
So the city doesn't have any leeway over the speed going through town?
The city talked to them when they, after late 90s, early mid-90s, they came by and wanted to raise the speed limit, and the city at that time said, no, we don't want you to, and that went away.
Okay.
So, but then if they raise the speed limit, that changes the calculation of your risk factors, which may then cause us not to have a quiet zone. Because the trains are going faster, it's harder to see them, and without the four quadrant gates, You don't get a quiet zone.
Councilor Kent, you still have the floor, but just let you know, I've been given information about 4 years ago from a state legislature slate for that it would indeed speed trains up through town. So
that it would?
Huh?
That it would?
That it would, yes. But
why? That's why.
Yeah, I was told by a state legislator that it would speed up the trains through town to city. Because what Councilmember Davis says, it enhances the safety. However, I've come to understand that is not the case.
Okay. Well, and that's what he.
Yeah.
I was understanding. That what I was wondering is if they are, well, like you said, from this legislator, that if we have a possibility of decreasing time of traffic being spent, or time of cars waiting for trains, that kind of thing, that would be definite plus.
But, yeah, most of the time, though, when you're waiting for long periods of time, it's when they're passing. So one of them has to stop.
That's true. Yeah.
You know, so.
It'd be nice to move the stop outside of the town.
Yeah.
That would help.
The mayor. Okay.
Councilor Campbell, anything further? Okay. Councilor Scarborough, you started to put your tent up. Yeah.
Well, seems to me I agree to your views. The price of putting in four of these things was astronomical, $40 million or something.
2.5.
But, and that comes out of our money, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So, what I'm kind of hearing you tell me is that our financial limitation option is basically the curve.
Correct.
So, and what I understand you say is can't pass two, we can probably get away with doing three of our intersections. And if we did that, that would mean no one between Woods Creek and the hot
place. And Snohomish.
And so it's
that's the next process. Actually, probably pick that number.
Well, the hospital in there.
Because you could do all five, because the quiet zone is calculated on the zone, and by putting the three supplementary safety measures in, it makes the zone have less risk.
So if we just spent the money on three of them, or just did the curb issue, then what did you say? It was 179th and Frederick
Boulevard.
Would be free effectively for insurance.
Well, maybe not. That's what this part's about.
Well, then I'll wait for that. Mr.
Calvert. So, the liability issue is out there. Becky might talk to this, what they did in Washougal. When we talked to WCIA, the person who had been there hadn't been there long enough to know that Washougal was a WCIA city and had gone through this process, because we were told that no WCIA city had done this. It happened, so WCIA obviously didn't have too big of a heart attack with it. And then also on the internet, there's mixed messages on people saying whether it is or whether it's not. The Federal Railroad Administration's website says, well, it's up to the court to determine who's liable for an accident. State of California, the California Joint Powers Insurance Authority, which is sort of like something in WCIA down there, they actually have a separate railroad quiet zone liability program. So they actually, you can sign up for supplemental insurance for liability at railroad crossings in the quiet zone. So do you have anything to add from Washougal?
So during my time in Washougal, we went through the same thing. And as Brad was mentioning, we had people coming out of the woodwork on both sides. And both sides had published reports about how it was a horrible idea from a liability standpoint and how there was no increase in liability whatsoever. So it really became to what's your risk tolerance, and they haven't had issues since it was put in. Now, in fairness, the railroad, where it goes through Washougal, there's also Highway 14 between the railroad and the more populated portions of the town. So we didn't have the railroad going through, you know, like downtown, etc. So there is a little bit of separation just by nature of where Highway 14 was compared to the river and compared to where all the building was going on. So I think that helps with the liability issue as well. But as far as Washougal and its size, it's probably about 3,000, 4,000 in population, a little smaller than what we are here. So it's a similar kind of feel. There's a hilly area where all the new construction went in and all the Portland and Vancouver money was moving into. And then you had the flat area where the downtown was, and then you have a major state highway going through. So there's a lot of similarities between the two towns. And the hills also helped the horn carry at night. So it was a major deal down there to do the quiet zone. And I don't remember it costing
you
a million.
Major for it or against?
No, pardon?
Major for it or against?
Most of the people were for it.
Okay.
They wanted the quiet zone, so.
Except for the person I saw on the internet who wrote the article about he was disappointed that there was no train horns, you know, wailing in the night, you know.
In the distance,
yeah. So,
not in my backyard, yeah, right.
A couple more things about this, though, and on the safety aspects, I guess, you know, because before we had the two quadrant gates in, we used to have lots of car accidents, car train accidents on the railroad crossings. You know, there were horns, they still got hit.
Yeah.
Now with the arms, it's dropped considerably. You know, so the other thing going forward, the liability issue, since the horns aren't going to be sounding, it probably would be, you know, not a bad idea to. Oops, went the wrong way. Add this at those two crossings also, just for a little extra safety for at least the one direction has, you can't zip around it. You know, the other ones are kind of, at least at Franklin's Boulevard, they have the no left, no right turn sign
right. When
the train's coming, and also the signals don't give you the left turn arrow when the trains are coming at those two.
So I'm just curious, so are you, we have the post or the curb or whatever at all the locations, which is what you're saying.
Yes.
And then, but if two of them were getting by on.
Two of them, they increased the safety measure, but the other three being on both sides increased the safety enough that we don't have to ask for special permission from the Federal Railroad Administration.
Councilmember Sperber.
Once again, the background of this movie. You may or may not know that the school buses don't have to stop at railroad crossings where there are gates.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have to stop and look by law. But every school district does it because they don't want the next slide that says liability.
Right.
Why you do it here and why you don't do it there is you take prudence and take the chance of kids on board. And I'm for a quiet zone, don't get me wrong, but I would really want to look at the school's input. As far as that put them and all that it would. And, you know, everybody else, like you said, you're going to have people coming in and out of the woodwork on both sides of this issue. So the liability is in how much is the insurance, the extra liability insurance. So, I don't know, kind of, there's lots of things in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we reached out to WCIA to ask them follow-up questions on that one, and I also know that the community transit buses stop at the rail crossings too before they cross. So the issues basically are the driveway closures, property access, you know, how that will affect people, getting together with WashDOT for the application for SR-203 Lewis Street, the type of train detection, the crossing signals have to have what's called constant time warning devices. And the current issue of the rail crossing inventory says that the Main Street, Lewis Street, and Kelsey Street have that, and don't say it for 179th and Franklin's Boulevard. They haven't been updated for a while. I think they actually do, because that's one of the things they need in order to get the intertie with the signals that make that little sign say no right turn. So I'm pretty sure it is. We just have to check with Burlington Northern to make sure that happens. If it hasn't been put installed yet, that would be a cost we'd have to pay to Burlington Northern to change their equipment to do that. The other thing is, one of the things we do is, once the council decides to go ahead with this, is we'll have to do a notice of intent to establish a quiet zone, which is a 60-day comment period in which the Washington Utility Transportation Commission, Burlington Northern, Amtrak, and the Washington State Department of Transportation get to give comments on what they think about that. It also costs us an issue. One of the things that Burlington Northern, Burlington Northern says, this is what they did up in Watkins County. I'm sure it's probably for their liability issues too. They say, at the outset of this letter, BNSF would like to be clear that we believe that if not properly accounted for with appropriate safety enhancements, the elimination of train horn can be detrimental to safety. The train horn is intended to alert the motorist and pedestrian public of train movement. The county's use of the rule should be used as a minimum guideline in its approach to creating a situation where the train horn is eliminated as a safety measure. For any quiet zone, we strongly recommend each crossing receive appropriate enhanced safety devices to accommodate for the removal of the horn prior to the establishment of the quiet zone. And that's one of the reasons I also suggest that we add the additional at the other two, even though for the points we don't need them, but it is an additional safety measure at those other crossings. And so probably if we did as much as we could do at all five crossings, it would probably cost somewhere around $100,000. Not withstanding anything that isn't quite right with BNSF that we got that additional money for. So the question before you is, should staff move forward with the process to establish a plan? So,
quick question. So that would be re-qualified?
Do you think it would be?
My initial reaction to that would be yes for first quarter read, but I want to do a little bit more research because it is street infrastructure. Mm-hmm. It is a crossing, and that is the streets are in allowable use. So
we have to amend the comprehensive capital facilities plan.
Okay. Thank you. Councilor Hanford.
Thank you. So a few questions. So first of all, where did the noise concern originate from?
Several places.
Yeah, several places. It's something that I hear about regularly.
That's,
and also, Ms. Knight is going to append what I just have to say.
Please. All you, please.
I would. Most recently, I heard complaints expressed at the hospital board meeting. So one of the biggest complaints that they have at the hospital from their patients is the train noise adjacent to the hospital. And so, you know, I think in order to keep and maintain good relationships both with the hospital and with existing businesses and new people moving into the community, I think this is a really inexpensive and relatively simple, after Mr. Falberg's research, way to address that problem. And it'll make Monroe's quality of life, I think, significantly better, especially for the new residents that are coming from urban areas where they're not used to this
world. So the hospital that built next to the railroad tracks
I think just times are changing, right? Yeah. And that people that used to be used to that. I also think that the number of trains has increased significantly over time, and so something that used to occur, you know, less frequently is now occurring significantly more frequently.
And you might add too, just in terms of comparative advantage, if you're going to have a hospital stay and, you know, you've got a choice of somewhere
quiet,
you know, toward Redmond or Bellevue or toward North Everett, if you're going to be in a long stay and that's a concern for you, you might choose to go somewhere else rather than our hospital, I would imagine.
I think that's
nice. And the same thing with attracting staff to do surgeries and things like that. Just some potential things.
I understand. I asked because I've never had one person surgery. At least that I can recall in the 6 years on council, approach me and say, we're going to do something about the train noise.
I can change that for you at the end of this meeting.
Councilor Hanford, just in me doing activities last year, I ran into the comment approximately three times. Sure. And it was approximately 3 to 4 times in the 4 years for that. Okay. And then I've been contacted once or twice. I don't remember if it was via email or a phone call. And these are different people. They're not the same people.
Okay.
Yield for answer to your question.
Sure.
I've had people that stayed the fairgrounds in complain about it. And I've had people right there at Wolfkill and in that area complain about it.
Okay. Can I add something to that?
Sure.
So I probably get one or two calls or emails a year from someone saying, okay, what are you going to do about the train? And then also, everybody's on jury duty at the Evergreen District Court. They actually stop the court proceedings when the train goes by because you can't hear what the witness is saying.
Yeah, and there are a couple properties also where there's been discussion of hotels or other things that might be appropriate depending upon other land uses that might change, like, you know, airports and things like that, where there has been an expression of concern that it's like, well, yeah, it would be good for a hotel there or something, but for the noise. Yeah.
I'm in a yielding mood.
Look at you.
No, those are
good. I can wait.
Okay, so... So my next question or point was that the citizens that I've heard from would probably rather have higher speeds over quiet zones. So I'm acknowledging all of your input, but I'm just saying from my experience, from what I've heard and from my own preference, I'd rather have a train go by much faster. Who cares about the horn, and then I'm getting on to across town where I need to be. So, is there a response to that, or no response?
Ms. Knight's got her. Ms. Knight.
And I don't necessarily know that I have a response. I guess it's more of a question for Mr. Feilberg, which is, this is the relatively inexpensive first step in order to get quiet zones. Mm-hmm. I think we do have a longer-term issue around train speeds, and Ms. Hassert suggested something in the note that she passed over to me, which is, if we really are interested in doing something bigger and longer-term, one thing might be to go and bond for that,
yeah,
through a public vote, right? So if you're looking for $4 million to do all of the train crossings, and that would get you a faster speed, or if doing an underpass at the main streets and US 2 crossing would get you faster speeds, then maybe that's something we could look at. But for this, I think for a first step, it's an excellent first step. It's the least expensive thing we can do. It solves a problem, an immediate problem. It makes our community more viable for economic development. And we can talk then more about the longer term issues.
Councilmember Hanford, just said before.
Thanks. So the next question I have was, so just for clarification, what you're proposing or presenting is that we go with the curb with the reflective posts in all of those slides that you showed. So we're going to be blocking off a couple driveways,
correct,
no left turns, and to look into the businesses over by Denny's, mm-hmm, Rite Aid, the entrance will be on Highway 2. So that's what you're suggesting. Mm-hmm. So we stick with the two, or presenting.
Right.
So we stick with the two arms coming down. We're not blocking the entire.
Right.
Because that was one concern I had, was if you block the entire railroad, now what do the police do when they need to get across? And the reason I'm saying that is because so many times I've seen the arms go down, there's not a train in sight, and I have to drive around myself because I'm not going to sit there forever, and all the cars just keep driving until finally a railroad truck pulls down and fixes the whatever caused the thing to stick down. So if they stick down, and now our cops can't even get to where they need to go because of a malfunction, that's kind of where I'm going with that. So you're suggesting not using any of those four things where it blocks the whole road. Okay.
And Councilmember Hanford, we would reach out to those property owners also that would be impacted if we were to put the curb in front of them, they couldn't turn left, right, you know, that kind of stuff, and if we had to close the driveway. So I heard Mr. Feilberg mention bringing somebody out on the railroad in a couple of those situations to have them look at it in more detail on site. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm not saying that it would do more than us, at least get more information about it.
Okay. And then my last question is, if the horns aren't going to be blown, will the bells still go off when the gates go down?
I'm done. Okay, cool. Okay. Councilman, cut it back.
So a couple things. So I'm glad you mentioned about reaching out to the business owners, because I think, you know, we've talked so much about trying to make traffic flow easier and people get in and out of business and businesses, and so this would impact people not being able to make certain turns and then certain businesses having to close off driveways. So I think it's important to, you know, I don't know if I, to be honest, want to move forward without getting a little input from them to go how they might prefer this going. Well, I'm willing to do that because we won't have the noise of the horns. I don't know, because I don't know how they feel about that with the horns, with their business and whatnot. So that would be important for me to know. And then I have concern if we were, I know you recommended doing all five, but I would not want us to just do something at the three. I don't think that.
Where?
I would recommend that if we're going to do something, we do something at all five. Like, and I think Brad was saying that, not just doing it at the three because we get enough points and we don't have to do the other two. That would concern me that we would only do safety measures at the three, even though we didn't, I guess, have to do it at the five. And then my question was about the funding and going, you know, how much REIT could we use for this? And then bond. Maybe to look at the public and go, is this really a priority for this community to do, and are people willing to pay for that for the longer term? And I guess maybe looking at that sooner than later, putting it out there. What's the time frame for that? I mean, you were saying that's a longer term solution, but if this is a big need in the community, what would be the timing for that?
Yeah, I think what you would want to do then as part of that five-year strategic plan discussion is take a look at everything that you are wanting to accomplish
right.
in that five-year period and prioritize this amongst everything else that you'd like to do. And if you want to move forward with evaluating then the cost of doing other measures, it would then just be using, I think, internal city revenue funds first
right.
to get to a point where you had a nice cost estimate. And once you had that cost estimate, then make a decision about how you wanted to finance it. So again, I think including that in your capital facilities plan, which we're going to be bringing to you later in the spring, and
okay.
incorporating then those costs into a 2019 budget, if that's where you want to spend your time and energy.
Okay.
And if I may just add
yeah.
one more point to that too. If we were to go and ask the voters and they approved bond, one of the cautions I would give is that in my experience from one of my prior lives that Brad has mentioned, the railroad moves slow. They will drag their feet on it before they get to that quiet zone because they don't like them. Let's be honest about it. Having said that, if you sell a bond, you have 3 years in which to expend those funds for
right.
the purpose you sell them for before you start running into IRS issues with those bonds. So you start a clock, so to speak, once you sell those bonds. So
would you recommend then that we get a quiet zone established with these other measures or methods and then go out for a bond and make permanent changes?
Not necessarily. What I would recommend is that if you're ready to really go for those permanent changes, be ready to break ground as soon as possible after you sell a bond.
And then, so about the speed, because I'm in agreement that if there's any way the trains could go faster, has there been any data that supports that? If you had the double arms going down, and if they're not blowing the horn, do they slow down? It seems like they blow the horn and slow down. If they're not blowing the horn, do they slow down? I mean, do we know this?
No.
Okay.
I mean, right now, most of the time they slow down is because they're maneuvering trains passing.
Right.
So even if they add a speed limit of 70 miles an hour, Amtrak can go through faster, but if you're passing the train, one's got to slow down and stop, and the other one, you know, has to wait until it gets there.
Okay, so you're saying right now, if they're not passing, they don't slow down through an intersection?
No, they go 45.
Okay.
Unless there's some reason.
It seems like they
have sometimes they have what's called slow workers or something like that. If there's something wrong with the track that they're inspectionist and it's a loose board or something, they slow down.
So same speed?
Yeah, the speed limit through town is 45 miles an hour.
Okay, and they do that no matter if they blow the horn, don't blow the horn, that's what the speed is.
Yeah.
And so there's not really much way to change that. The only option to make them go faster is to have them pass up by the town.
If there was not a path, they could go faster. Because sometimes you see the trains go through at 45 miles an hour.
Okay.
Times
I thought they slowed down a little bit. It always seems like they go slower through the intersection.
Yeah.
It's probably a mind train.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Councilmember Scarborough.
To actually get on a little bit on one of the things, and that was but the other is I forgot that too.
We love it.
I know what I was going to tell you. I looked it up, and there's at least 23 trains a day. Why not 24? I don't know. But basically,
it's
about 1 hour.
Thank you, Councilor Scarborough. Councilor Camp,
thank you. Roughly, so you're thinking about $100,000 for this first step implementation.
Yes.
And I know that's
rough. Right. Yeah.
But just high level, we're talking about the actual materials for the curbs, anything with, if we have to start closing the parking lots, that kind of thing.
That's, yeah, so really not including that. That's just the materials and labor to put the mountable mediums with reflectorized traffic control devices in.
So it's really kind of a conservative estimate. Kind of,
yeah.
So in the neighborhood, I think.
And then also, we assume that if we buy that much of it, we might get a better price on the materials.
Right.
You know, so.
Okay, that makes sense. I have received some information from the public about this, and this one person who's been here for 12 years, they are attending their first council meeting tonight just to hear about this train issue. Speed is not the issue, but the noise matters. Regarding the question we have up there, I think we should look at it, what the items that Councilmember Cutback has mentioned about finding out more from the business owners what the impacts will be. And setting up and doing something for every intersection would make more sense than just doing three and hoping for the best. If we can't have a physical barrier for even those tubes that hopefully will slow somebody up from zipping around in their gate, I would like us to look at the option of having the four gates come down. Just, I think it's safer, and hopefully it will slow someone down from trying to do something stupid across those roads. But yeah, I think we should move forward on this, at least for the investigation part of this one.
Quick question, what's the cost of the fourth quadrant again? For the $250,000?
About $700,000 per crossing.
Okay.
Yeah.
And would we have to do it all by crossing?
Right. You don't have the 60 feet one at a minimum. I know that we're talking about having a bond and more issues like that. I'm sorry to interrupt. As an option, I know it's going to be very expensive.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Thank you, Councilor Scarborough.
There you are.
You need to write it down.
The other thing is, and it goes along with it. Jeff Kovac said, and the businesses that may be affected by it have to have the briefing that there's a trade-off. If Denny's doesn't want all the horn bone, then they're going to have the limited access to that. If Fairgrounds Inn wants limited horn bone, they're not so effective, but they might have an input. Down at Main Street, there's some businesses there that I've heard from. If they don't want the horn blowing, then they have to live with the consequences too. So when it's presented to them, they have to know there's a trade-off. If you want the horns, you're going to have some limited access. So just so when they give their input, they realize that
they have everything to make a decision on. So that public access of Ms. Cutback's talking about is, I think, important, and that this person is talking about.
Okay, thank you. All right, anything further on this?
It's all for me.
So what I'm understanding is a consensus to move forward on the conceptual level, and then after you've got a little bit more information, then proceeding a meeting with the neighbors.
Yes.
That will be impacted. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Crowley.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Brad.
The next item we have on our agenda this evening is discussion item number 3. This is AB 18-058, Streamline Sales Tax Marketplace Fairness Act. We have Ms. Hasser.
Well, I thought I'd move down here so I can see that. So basically, for those of you that might have had a chance to read the bill that was in your packet, this was an answer to a question we had from council about the streamlined sales taxes. So to give you a little history, back in the 2000s, the aughts, the state, the sales taxes were always done based on point of order. So for example, you know, we have
Canyon Creek,
thank you, just went flying out of my head.
Did you have that too?
More often than I want to admit. that we used to get a lot of sales taxes from them because they were manufacturing here but delivering everywhere else. Boeing, Renton, you know, they're making planes in Renton for all over the world. You know, Renton was collecting quite a bit of sales tax from all of that. Well, you know, there was something called the internet starting to pick up. Before that, it was catalog sales. And there had been a court case back in, I want to say, the 90s, Quill versus North Dakota, where North Dakota tried to tax catalog sales, specifically in this case, floppy disks. And they said, wait a minute, we don't have a presence in your state, we don't have a store, why do we owe you sales taxes? The Supreme Court agreed with them and said, look, if they don't have a brick-and-mortar presence in your state, you can't tax catalog sales. Fast forward a little bit, now the internet's coming along, floppy disks don't even exist anymore. The other thing that Quill did say was that at the national level, the U.S. Congress could allow us the option to tax, but they would have to pass legislation to do it. The couple of times that the Senate has actually passed what they call the Marketplace Fairness Act, the House did not. So we, according to Quill, are precluded at the state level from being able to impose sales taxes on remote sales, to use the term to capture both catalogs and internet. The other issue that was happening is, as talk was out there that these states wanted to start taxing because they're losing their sales from brick and mortar, is that all the smaller businesses are saying, wait a minute, there's so many different ways that all these different states, and even within the states, the different cities and counties do sales taxes, it would be an administrative nightmare for us to try and track and make sure sales taxes are being collected and going to the right places. And the representatives were hearing that. So there was 41 states that got together and said, okay, we hear you. We need to come up with this agreement among ourselves to be a little bit more uniform on how we do sales. So they came up with what they call the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement. And they said that, look, when we all come into compliance with this voluntarily, we're going to go back to Congress and say, look, we're trying to make things easy for the businesses. We want to be able to tax sales, remote sales. We want fairness for our brick and mortars because they're losing sales because those that are doing it remotely have an unfair competitive advantage. Come on, Congress, you got to do something. Congress kind of hinted that, okay, we may consider this. And again, that was one of the issues, or one of the times where the Senate did pass it, but then again, the House turned around and didn't. There was also one of the Supreme Court justices, and I forget his name, which one, but kind of hinted that maybe it was time to look at this again because, let's be honest, floppy disks aren't around anymore, technology has changed. Maybe we should too, kind of thing. So it kind of opened the door to it. Well, now here's what, so now let's bring Washington into the mix. The SSUTA, specifically talked about sales taxes being destination-based. So
so that if you've got somebody in Seattle ordering online from a company in, say, South Carolina, who's then going to deliver it to a friend in Arizona, where's the sales tax going to go? You got to take a spot. The FSCTA said point of destination. For Washington to be at the table, to be part of the conversation at the national level about sales taxes on remote sales, we needed to come into compliance with that agreement. That's why back in, I think it was 2003, the first move towards that was done here locally in our legislature to start looking at sales taxes. They didn't quite go destination-based yet, but they did change some of the categories of what was taxed and what wasn't in order to start coming in line with the FSCTA. 2007 was actually when, and then they started the conversation among cities. Now, I should mention, because I remember all of this when it went on, it was extremely contentious among all the cities. You had your Rentons, your Kents of the world, that had a lot of warehousing that was going to lose a lot of money to go to destination base versus some of your other or places that were more rural that were going to actually see increases because a lot of their people were ordering remotely. Now, if you're ordering remotely and they did have a brick and mortar in the state, they were fair game already. With the FSCTA, what the state coalition did is they went out and they contacted folks like Amazon and actually got a lot of retailers to voluntarily start collecting taxes with the agreement that, okay, they kind of say, they see the writing on the wall, this is going to happen. We don't want you to come back to us and hit us with liability and penalties after the fact. So we'll voluntarily collect now. We think it's the right thing to do, kind of thing. Anyway, despite contentiousness, the state did pass destination-based sales taxes so we could come in full compliance with the FSCTA that went into effect July of 2007. But part of what was negotiated before they got there was that for those cities that were going to lose quite a bit of money, and the one in particular I can think of is Yakima, that had the best case, they had a lot of bonds outstanding where the underlying security for those bonds was their sales tax. And they were going to lose more than what they needed to be able to make those bond payments. And they didn't want to see that happen to anybody. That's why they started the streamlined sales tax mitigation. And the intent of the mitigation has always been to be weaned off after a period of about 5 years. Of course, it's been 11 years now, and there's still mitigation coming. So at this point, we've already been informed by the state that as of 18 is the last year we're going to get mitigation, the state has now, even though we're in compliance with FSCTA, we have locally here to try and move things along, adopted a Marketplace Fairness Act as well. We called it the same thing here in Washington with the idea that we're going to start telling these companies they've got to collect sales taxes. Other states have already been trying to do this. Other states that are party to this agreement, most notably Colorado and South Dakota. Both of those have had states put on their enforcement efforts through their own court systems. What's interesting is that South Dakota v. Wayfair, actually petitioned the Supreme Court to hear it, and they have accepted the case. So while there is a stay out there, there's a lot of states that have written friendly court briefs in support of South Dakota, so that SCOTUS will look at it and possibly overturn the old Quill case and say, look, that no longer really applies. States need to have authority to be able to collect taxes in appropriate ways. And there's a lot of support for the brick and mortar, quite frankly, on this too, because they want a level playing field. So that's kind of somewhat brief. And hopefully, I mean, you guys are all looking at me like this, so you know, if you have any questions, let me know. Where we're at now is that, like I said, the Supreme Court has agreed to hear South Dakota v. Wayfair. Arguments are scheduled for April. A ruling is expected before they end session in June. So we're all waiting with bated breath to see what happens with that.
Cool. Thank you. Questions, comments? Ms. Hauser, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. We have nothing further on the agenda this evening. Is there a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Okay. Have a motion to adjourn from Councilmember Campbell, a second from Councilmember Rasmussen. Any discussion on the motion to adjourn? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes 7-0. Thank you very much for coming this evening. Well, have a great rest of your week.
Thanks. Thank you.